So this lecture is about a conceptual introduction to the brain. And it's meant not as a bunch of facts thrown at you that you're meant to memorize, but instead it's to give you a sense of how neuroscientists think about their work and how the brain sort of functions and how you can be an informed consumer of brain research as an educator. So I don't want you to come away trying to memorize all the terms and all the parts and all the locations. Instead, I want you to really try to think critically as you watch about how the brain organizes itself as a system, the relationship between your experiences as a learner and the organization of your brain, and then how that's then going to play into your later learning, because those are the aspects of neuroscience that are relevant to education. So today we're going to look at each of the cortical lobes, and you'll know what those are in a second, and a few of their major systems and parts, like the corpus callosum that joins the two hemispheres, and the cingulate cortex, which has to do with the limbic lobe and mediating emotions, and some other parts. But first, I thought we should start small, because I want you to get a sense of the tiny units that make up the huge, you know, 3/4 pounds of tissue that is our brain. And these are some pictures of neurons. And neurons are the little cells that make up nervous tissue in the body. And on the left is a picture of one single cell. It's called a Purkinje cell. These cells are found in the cerebellum, which you'll know what that is in a minute. I'll just kind of point to it on the model for you. This brown part on the back here is the cerebellum, kind of in the back of your head. And what this cell does, I just want you to get a little sense of this cell's activity based on its structure, is it sort of sums across lots of inputs and smooths out learning, both motor learning and cognitive learning. It kind of grabs across a whole bunch of other cells and says, what's common to all these experiences, and sort of sums it up into one place. So you can sort of see how that cell functions that way. And on the right is a slide that's a slice of cortex, which is the bark on the outside of the brain. I'll just hold this up right here. This pink stuff with the folds and convolutions all over it, that's the cortex. Okay. And I want you to get a sense of how different these two kinds of neurons are, and that their functions are different. So in that picture on the right, there are little black spots. Those spots are the cell bodies, and those cell bodies hold the nuclei, which has the DNA, the genetic material, the organelles that control the rest of the cell. And then the long black spikes going up and down are the axons of the neurons, and we'll know what that is in a minute, but it's the long tails going out to communicate with other neurons. And I just want you to get a sense of how the cortex is. These cells are lined up in rows, in layers. It turns out to be 6 layers, only 5 of which have cell bodies in them, but 6 layers. And these cells communicate up and down, back and forth with each other. And so it's sort of a different organization than the cerebellum. I just want you to get a sense of what some of these different cells look like. This is a third cell. This is a neuron from the hippocampus. The hippocampus is the part of the brain that is responsible for consolidating long-term memory. So it's very important for learning and for education. And I just want you to see how different this neuron looks, for one thing. The middle orange, the yellow, is the cell body. You can see the nucleus and the nucleolus, which is just a little organelle inside the nucleus. And it's got all projections going out sort of 3D into space, connecting with other neurons. So that's sort of another view of what the brain looks like at a microscopic level. And so I have a few little neuron factoids for you, just to give you a sense of how massive and how complex the system of the brain is. Many people say, and I think I would agree, that the human brain is the most complex system known to man, more complex than the universe. That remains to be told. But it's a huge and extremely intricate system. And as educators, we need to understand that so that we don't think we can just change things easily or teach to one side or the other, or, you know, silly oversimplifications like that. So that's what these factoids are meant to demonstrate. So before birth, neurons proliferate at a rapid rate. They're dividing into more and more and more cells, and they migrate to various locations in the brain, so they're spreading around, and then they differentiate. They become different kinds of cells. the Purkinje cells that we saw from the cerebellum or the cerebral cortex cells from the hamster, for instance. And this is happening on a massive scale. Between the 5th and the 20th weeks of gestation in the fetus, 50,000 to 100,000 new brain cells are generated each second. So it gives you a sense of just the hugely fast growth of neurons in the fetal brain. And approximately 75% of these neurons that are generated during fetal development will later undergo apoptosis, which means programmed cell death. They're meant to die. And approximately 40% of the connections that are present at birth will be pruned back. And my point here is that this is an essential process for normal brain development and normal cognitive development. There are, for instance, some experiments going on with mice where they've genetically altered them to undergo less apoptosis and keep more neurons in their brains, and they perform far inferior to normal mice, for instance. And there are certain kinds of mental retardation that are associated with maintaining too many neurons and not pruning them back and not pruning back the connections. So you can sort of think of the young brain as sculpting a garden. You don't want the weeds just growing everywhere. More and more and more plants doesn't make a better garden. You want your garden to be shaped and pruned in just the right places to function optimally. And a three-year-old has about twice as many connections as an adult. This is interesting because it gives you a sense of how many connections get actually pruned back. And now we're not talking about how many cells there are, but we're talking about how those cells connect to one another. And we'll be talking about that more in more detail in a second. But it has to do with how the cells are connecting to each other and networking. And a three-year-old has about twice as many connections as an adult. Those get pruned back. And we know that three-year-olds aren't smarter than adults, right? So my point is also, more is not always better with the brain. And the human body contains more than 100 billion neurons. There are neurons throughout your body, in the nervous tissue, in your nerves, and in your spinal cord, and also in your brain. And the neurons in the brain make about 15,000 to 200,000 connections each. So we've got 100 billion neurons, and the ones in the brain are making 15,000 to 200,000 connections each. It's just a hugely complex and interconnected network. And in the brain, glia, which are support cells, there are various kinds of glia, but they're the little cells that are going around cleaning up tiny blood clots or wrapping themselves around axons to insulate them, all these sorts of little jobs, cleaning up dead cells. They outnumber the neurons at least 10 to 1. No one really knows exactly how much. So the brain is just a hugely complex piece of tissue, and the neurons are only one small part of it. And there are about a billion synapses in a cubic centimeter of brain tissue. And the length of myelinated nerve fibers in the brain, so those are the nerve fibers, we're going to talk about myelin in a minute, that's the insulation, but the combined length of those fibers crossing around the brain, connecting with each other, is about 150,000 to 180,000 kilometers. So there's just a huge amount of interconnectivity in the brain. In neuronal communication, we have a neuron. And you can see a diagram of one on your screen. On one side of the neuron is the cell body. We saw a picture, the picture of the hippocampal neuron especially showed the cell body well. And then it's got these dendrites all around it that are receiving information from other cells. And then the information shoots down the axon, and the axon is wrapped up in these sort of fatty sheaths. On your screen, these cells look green, but in real life they're white because they're made with a lot of fat, and they insulate the neuron to improve its conductivity. The electrical impulse goes shooting down the axon, which is insulated, and it gets to these little boutons going off at the other side with these little presynaptic terminals, and the signal gets there and then gets transmitted to another neuron, which we'll talk about that in a second. So the point here is I want you to get a sense of that the brain is a piece of tissue that's incredibly complex, but that works by basic physical and chemical properties. There's no magic going on in there. You actually have neurons firing with electricity and spitting little chemical signals at each other, and that is what makes up ourselves, really. Our sense of consciousness, our cognition, our emotion, all those things come from that. So I want you to have just a tiny sense of how neurons communicate with each other. Once again, so you understand sort of the physical basis of how the brain works. The neuron is receiving inputs from all of its dendrites that are synapsing onto other neurons. That means going right next to them so that it can receive chemical signals from them, but not actually touching it. And then the chemical signal, when the neuron fires, and we'll talk about when that happens in a minute, shoots in and down the axon, down the membrane of the axon, which is insulated by these special fatty cells, and gets to the end. And then the little inset on the right of your screen shows a close-up picture of what these little boutons look like synapsing onto the dendrites of the postsynaptic neuron, of the next neuron that's going to receive the message. And basically, the two come very, very close together, and there's a little tiny space in between, and special little vesicles hold tiny chemicals in there, which function differently in different kinds of tissue. And the chemicals that are in there are called neurotransmitters. Things like serotonin and dopamine, you may have heard of them. And those get spit out into the little cleft in between the two neurons, and then the other neuron has special docking ports, like little doorways that fit specific kinds of neurotransmitters and sucks them back up. And that gives the signal to the next neuron. And I want to point out also that neurons can be very, very small, the ones in the brain, for instance, the ones we saw in the cerebral cortex of the hamster, but they can also have very, very long distances that cross which they communicate. So, for instance, the neuron that is responsible for the feeling in the end of your big toe has one single neuron running all the way up your leg and to your spinal cord in your back. So you've got one single neuron that's, 3 feet long or something like that. So basically, in the communication between neurons, what happens is neurotransmitters, which are those special chemicals I talked about being in the little vesicles in the boutons on the end of the neuron, those chemicals are released into the cleft. This little diagram shows the process of them releasing and docking into the postsynaptic neuron. It doesn't look very anatomical in that the space is way too big, and they really curl around each other. But they release the chemicals. And then the postsynaptic membrane has these special little docking ports, or little doorways that fit only specific chemicals. And then once those chemicals, those neurotransmitters, attach to the postsynaptic membrane, there's a change in the potential, the electrical potential of the membrane in the next cell, and that determines the summing, the combination of all those changes across all of the dendrites and all of the different neurons that are communicating with this neuron determine whether or not this neuron is going to fire or not. So basically, each neuron is synapsing into many different neurons, and each synapse is a partial contributor to the overall state of the membrane, that is, the potential for it to fire or not fire. And some synapses on a single neuron will be telling it not to fire, some synapses are telling it to fire, and it's the summing of all these things all together that determines whether or not the neuron will actually fire. And that's all that neurons can do. They can either fire, they can fire more, they can fire less, but they don't fire more strongly. They're either on or they're off, and that is all that there is to make up the brain. And I just want to point out that neuroactive drugs like Ritalin or MEOIs for depression or Prozac, so this is how they work. They selectively act on these different types of neurotransmitters. They might interfere with the way that the transmitter is released into the cleft from the presynaptic neuron. They might interfere with or change the way that it's handled once it's in the cleft, for instance, by stopping the presynaptic neuron that released it from sort of vacuuming it back up, sucking it back up so it stays there longer and has more chance to act on the second neuron. Or they might change the way that the postsynaptic neuron, the neuron that's that it's synapsing onto, it can, like it might plug up those little doorways so that that neuron doesn't feel the effects of the neurotransmitter coming at it. And when you do this, the likelihood of that neuron firing is changed, and changing the likelihood across a whole bunch of neurons actually can change how a person behaves and thinks and feels. And that's basically how those drugs act. So I want to stop now and kind of give you the big principle of what we've been learning so far. And that is that synaptic change, so the ways that the neurons are synapsing onto each other, which neurons they're connecting to, and how actively, how ready they are to fire or how ready they are to not fire, that is the mechanism of learning. All learning is embodied in the sum of that process over billions of neurons. Okay, so now we're going to step back to the big picture again, okay? And the biggest picture that you can have of the brain is that it has two hemispheres. We've all heard of these. You can see in the brain model that there's sort of a crack down the middle, and then there are two sides. You're looking at the top of the brain right now, okay? This is looking at it on the side. There we go. And those two sides, that crack is actually anatomical. Those two sides are the two hemispheres that I'm talking about. So now we've moved up to the cerebral cortex, which is the bark on the outside of the brain. We saw a picture of it in the hamster. It's layered cells in six layers, all wrinkled and folded all around to be able to fit more of them. If you were to unfold your cerebral cortex, it would be like the size of a large pizza, and you can't fit that in your head, so it convolutes itself all up. Okay, so contrary to what you've heard in, like, you know, car commercials where the left hemisphere is saying, you know, this car is such a bargain and it's analytical and thinking about the numbers, and the right hemisphere is saying, I love to drive this car, and it's all emotional. That's really not, that's a really a huge oversimplification of the way that the hemispheres interact, and I just want to give you a little sense of that. So any curriculum, for instance, that tells you you're teaching to this hemisphere, you're teaching to that hemisphere, is that's just kind of ridiculous. Because really in real life, both hemispheres are very highly interconnected, and we'll talk about how anatomically in a minute. And for most tasks, surely any kind of complex task at all, both hemispheres are involved in the processing. They have characteristically different kinds of processing, but both hemispheres have to come together to make an intact final process. So, for example, in the different components of language, language was originally thought to be housed in the majority of people in the left hemisphere. So things like words and syntax, grammar, meaning, and production of words, being able to understand them, are mostly housed in the left hemisphere in the majority of people. But it turns out that the right hemisphere actually has a critical role to play in language, but it's a different one, and that the two hemispheres have to come together to make really good functional language that can be pragmatic and that we would call, you know, competent languages. And that is, it deals with the sort of melody of the language, the intonation of the language, being able to get the emotion from the language, to know that even though someone's saying, oh, I'm having a really nice day, they're being sarcastic by the tone of their voice. Being able to tell that somebody's angry when they're speaking something to you. Or also simple things like being able to distinguish a statement from a question, like, you know, I'm giving a video lecture. I'm giving a video lecture? Someone without their right hemisphere language areas would not hear the difference between those two things, when clearly one's a question, one's a statement. So they're really fundamentally, they have different communicative intent. It also deals with very basic processes like conversational turn-taking and monitoring the gestalt of the conversation. So knowing when to interrupt somebody, knowing when it's your turn to talk and when it's their turn to talk, being able to modulate your voice so you talk at an appropriate volume, things like that are all handled in the right hemisphere. So it's really an inaccurate assessment to say that the left hemisphere handles all of language, because it only handles the words, the grammar, the syntax, the things we generally think of as language, but that aren't the functional aspects of language. But there's always a cautionary note in there. In some 25% of left-handed people, it appears that actually their primary language is in the right hemisphere. So it just keeps you on your toes and guessing, knowing that things can actually be rearranged given certain kinds of genetic profiles and certain kinds of experiences. Now, I also want to point out that the hemispheres control the contralateral side of the body. Now, this is not true for the cerebellum, the brown part that I showed you that's on the back earlier. But all the somatosensory inputs and outputs come up from the body, and they cross over, and they project themselves onto the opposite side in the cortex. So my left cortex controls my right hand, for instance. My right cortex controls my left hand. Mostly, although certain kinds of skills that are specializations can involve, you know, one hemisphere over the other preferentially, like writing, for instance, or playing the piano. Okay, so the two hemispheres are joined together by a band of tissue called the corpus callosum. And what you're seeing on your screen is two views of the corpus callosum. The one on the left with the yellow stripe through it is showing you a split this way through somebody's head, opening up this way. And what you're seeing is a band of white, fatty fibers that are going across through the middle of the brain to the other side, back and forth. And those, of course, are all the axons of all those neurons that we were talking about before, communicating with the other side, sending lots of axons across back and forth so that the two hemispheres are interconnected. And the picture that you see on the right is a structural MRI. It basically gives you a three-dimensional picture of the structure of someone's brain. And it's a cut through this way. And what you're seeing in the middle there is a little white tract above the two black holes, which are ventricles. Those are fluid on which the rest of the cortex is floating. You see a little white tract going from left to right and right to left. That is the corpus callosum in the other view. So I'm going to show you on the model. Okay, so if I take apart this brain, split it in half, and I'm holding it upside down, of course. Okay, so this is right side up. This is the back. This is the cerebellum. This is the front behind your forehead. Your eyes are right here in these little holes. This right here, this tract, is the corpus callosum. So it's a quite a wide bunch of fibers that are crossing across to communicate between hemispheres. Okay. Now, in certain kinds of epileptic patients who have very severe seizures, basically sort of electrical storms, kind of lightning storms in the electrical impulses that are going down these neurons, and those can disrupt the function of the neuron because they're just these random high-intensity storms, they can ruin the neuron's learning because it changes, every one of those firings is changing the way that the neuron behaves and connects to other neurons. And if it's just a random firing that doesn't have to do with experience, then that can degrade the performance of the person's neurons, right, to the point of retardation if left unchecked. So in some kinds of epilepsy that can't be controlled with drugs, the corpus callosum can actually be surgically severed to prevent the spread of seizures from one hemisphere to the other. So if one hemisphere is the focal point where the seizures are starting, and then they're sending all this electrical energy that is sort of random over into the other hemisphere, you don't want to spread that around the brain. So sometimes they'll cut the corpus callosum to prevent the spread. And these split brain patients, as they're called, enable us to see how the two hemispheres function when they're isolated from each other. So we've learned actually quite a lot from these people. And this is one way to study what each hemisphere does. But a strong cautionary note, you're looking here at what each hemisphere does when it's isolated from the other one, not what it does when it's working with the other one necessarily. It gives you a sense of what it can do on its own, but that's not necessarily what it does when it's working in concert with the other one. So for instance, for an analogy, you walk with both legs. If you break your left leg and you have to hop on your right leg, looking at how your right leg functions when your left leg is broken doesn't exactly tell you what it did before when both legs were there, because you don't hop on it when the other leg's there. It's a modified function to be able to compensate for a disability. So we need to keep that in mind. And also, there are some examples of types of tasks that can't be done without both hemispheres working in concert. So for instance, there's a famous neuroscientist named Gazzaniga who had these complex wire figures, and a patient before corpus callosotomy was able to identify them with either his left or his right hand without looking. And of course, when it's only in his left hand, it's going to his right hemisphere first and then back and forth across the corpus callosum, or the opposite from his right hand. Once his corpus callosum was severed, he could not identify the wire figures in either hand. So when it now went into his left hand, it only went to his right hemisphere. It couldn't go across. He couldn't identify it, and he couldn't identify it in the opposite way either. So the task involved both hemispheres working in concert to be able to accomplish it. And another example is probably complex emotional functioning, where it was originally thought that perhaps, or hypothesized that perhaps, one hemisphere was positive, one hemisphere was negative, and simple kinds of scenarios like that, and that they're sort of going back and forth. But actually, it's much more complex than that. That intact complex emotions actually involve the feedback between both hemispheres, and that if either hemisphere is missing or damaged, that can impact in characteristic ways someone's emotions. Okay, so the basic experimental technique is that a picture is presented to either one hemisphere or the other. If the person has a split brain, if you present it in their to their left or to their right visual field, or to their left or right hand only behind a screen, then the information is coming in and going to the other side. So if they're seeing it on the left, it's coming to their right side. If they're seeing it on the right, it's coming to their left side. And it can't go across. So you can isolate the two hemispheres and see what each one does by itself. And you find out, can a person name an object? Can a person identify an object in an array? And the basic findings are that if you're giving the information to the left hemisphere in most people, then people can name it, because that's where the names and the language is. And if you're giving it to the right hemisphere, they can't name things, but they might be able to just identify them. Okay? They also, if you give something only to the right hemisphere, interestingly, people deny having seen anything. And if you force them and say, well, just make a guess, pick from this array of things, which one of these things did you see a picture of? they tend to correctly guess, even though they think that they're just making a haphazard guess. So there's something about the left hemisphere that's dominant in most people, and that's also brings things into explicit consciousness, probably through language. Okay, and some other basic findings about the hemispheres are that the right hemisphere usually doesn't have complex language, we've just talked about that, or control of speech, but it can have very simple language. So for instance, if you play into someone's left ear who has a corpus callosotomy, it's going to just their right hemisphere. If you play D, O, G to them, they can't tell you what they've heard. In fact, they deny having heard anything. But if you give them an array of stuffed animals, one of which is a dog, and ask them to pick, they can, with their left hand only, right, pick the dog. But their right hand, they can't pick the dog because that's the left hemisphere controlling the right hand, and the left hemisphere doesn't know what the right hemisphere saw. Okay? And the right hemisphere tends to be stronger on block design type spatial tasks. And additional evidence from lesion patients shows that damage to the right parietal areas, which are further back in your brain, and we'll be talking about those in a minute, can lead to substantial sensory neglect. We'll talk about what that looks like in a minute. While damage to the same areas on the left side, for instance, leads to a different kind of neglect and much less neglect. So the point is that the two hemispheres aren't identical, even though spatial information tends to be handled in the same general locations on each side, or language in the same general locations on each side. Okay, so this gets us to a basic brain functioning principle, and that is that all cognitive abilities result from an interaction of many small, simple processing mechanisms that that are distributed. You don't have sort of a music area or even a language area. You have an area that is where language is primarily processed, but that really involves the intercognitivity of many different smaller processing mechanisms that come together to produce, say, functional language or music. And the other point here is that different neuropsychological processing capacities will be recruited for different tasks that on the surface may seem similar, depending on how it is that you're engaging with that task. So, for instance, you don't have a music area, but for a classical pianist, say, we know that understanding the syntax and the logic of the formal composition of music recruits what were previously thought of as language areas in the left hemisphere, like Broca's area, for instance. But also recruits the right hemisphere where sort of melody and contour is processed. And so musicians get a very expanded corpus callosum because of all the interconnectivity going back and forth and talking between the two hemispheres to produce this kind of music. But you would expect something like, say, you know, tonal singing in the Himalayas or something, which is also music, to recruit a slightly different set of processing mechanisms in the brain because the task that you're putting to the mind is a slightly different one. So my point is that you can't just kind of pat say that certain things are processed in certain places. It depends on functionally and logically how you are approaching that task and the demands you're placing on your mind. Okay? So there are lots of methods of studying the structure and the function of the brain. And I just, the point of this list is to just give you a sense of what some of those are and just to give you a sense that there are a lot of them, okay? So you can use lesion studies. That's sort of a classical approach. And basically what happens there is some tissue in the brain dies by an accident or in animals because it's ablated. And then you look and see how the cognitive functioning of the person or the animal changes after the accident. And once again, just like with the corpus callosotomy, that doesn't give us a sense of what was happening in the tissue that's now dead. Instead, it gives us a sense of how the rest of the brain compensates when that's not there, which does give you sort of an indirect idea of what that piece of tissue might have been doing. But like the hopping leg, it's not exactly accurate, so you need to be careful in interpreting that. There are also neuroimaging studies, which are all the rage now because they allow you to look inside a living, functioning human brain without hurting the person. So you can actually have the person doing different kinds of tasks that you designed for them and watch how the blood flow in their brain changes. And then we assume, but it's not been proven, that the blood flow correlates with neuronal activity in some way that's systematic. And it's generally assumed to be true because it makes sense at this point. And then there are postmortem structural studies of things like gross anatomy, of cytoarchitecture, like of how the cells connect. You can only do those, you know, after death. So, for instance, an example of a finding there is that autistic people tend to have bigger brains than normal people. But interestingly enough, among autistics, those with the biggest brains tend to be the highest functioning. So there's sort of this interesting convoluted relationship between brain size and cognitive functioning in autistics, and that was originally found through postmortem structural studies. Now it's being studied with structural MRI, where you can try to measure the size. There's also direct cortical stimulation, where you actually poke somebody's brain and see what they experience. And that happens in preparation for neurosurgery. Doctors will poke around and ask the person what they're subjectively experiencing so that they can localize the functions in the brain before they start cutting, so that they don't cut out the person's language function or something like that. Because brains are like faces. All those convolutions that you saw on the cortex are generally similar from person to person. They're not just random. They're organized the same way in most people, but it's kind of like a face. Everybody's got eyes and nose down the middle and lips across and ears level with the eyes and cheeks and everything, but everyone's face is proportioned slightly differently, and the brain is sort of the same way. Functions can move around a little bit. Okay, that leads us to a basic principle of interpreting neuroscience research, and that is that the strengths and the limitations of research methods have important implications for the design of the experiments and the interpretation of the results. So whenever you see like an fMRI study result or a PET result or some other kind of result, you need to ask yourself, what were the demands of the task on the participants, and what is it that they were measuring? And how did they calculate their results? So for instance, in fMRI, the basic way that the experiment is designed is that you have two tasks, which are hopefully identical except for one small feature of the task, and then you look at the difference in blood flow between the two tasks. You literally get the blood flow from the one and the blood flow from the control task, and then you subtract, and what's left over is your result. Well, that doesn't tell you what the person's brain was doing during the task in order to do the task. What it tells you is the difference between those two tests. So that's a very important thing to keep in mind when you're interpreting that kind of research. Okay, so I want to give you a little quick tour of the different lobes of the cerebral cortex. The cortex is divided up by neuroscientists into some discrete parts that we can talk about as having characteristic kinds of functions. And today we're going to talk about them as being primary functions and association functions. So that means primary functions are the most direct cortical connections between the body, either the sensing or the motor, and the cortex, which is not to say that it's the first or primary place that that either somatosensory or motor information comes or goes through the brain. It's relayed through lower subcortical brain structures, which are the structures underneath. Let me show you those. Okay, so this brain is upside down, and you're looking at the back. This is the cerebellum, the cortex under here. These structures that are coming down, now you're looking at the front, are what's called the brainstem, and they project up inside underneath the cortex. And all these parts under here are sort of the first place that hooks onto the spinal cord here, well, that's attached to the spinal cord, and that information is going up and down from the brain. So the information that comes up from the body and that goes down is relayed through a place called thalamus and other places here out to the cortex. So we're talking about once it's been relayed and the sort of basic reflexes have been handled, now we're getting to the parts that do the sort of higher order thinking and associating information together. So that's, I just want to be clear that that's what we're talking about. As we saw before, the cerebral cortex is divided into lobes, and it is floating on these ventricles of fluid. And we saw a picture of those before in the slide that showed the cross-sectional structural MRA, in which I pointed out the corpus callosum going back and forth. And those little balloons of fluid support the cortex because the brain is very gelatinous and doesn't have a lot of internal structure, and it would smash on itself. Its own weight would prevent it from functioning well if it weren't floating. So those are there. And like in infants, when pediatricians measure the circumference of an infant's head, one of the main things they're looking for is that the head's not growing too fast, which would indicate that those ventricles, the fluid in those ventricles is not draining properly, and that the ventricles are expanding and smashing the brain tissue against the skull, which would damage it and lead to hydrocephaly. Right? So they can install shunts to drain it if that's the case. Okay, so we said we were going to be learning through lesions, and, you know, this guy has got one. He's a famous case from 1848. His name is Phineas Gage. You may have heard of him. His skull and this pole are on reserve at Harvard Medical School Library. You can go see them for yourself. But what happened was he was working on the railroad, and there was an explosion that sent a tamping iron an inch and a quarter in diameter up flying right through the front of his head, through his eye and out. And I have the newspaper article from the time. Phineas P. Gage, a foreman on the railroad, was yesterday engaged in tamping for a blast. The thing exploded. It flung it through his head. Went through the back of his left eye and out the top of his head. So think about what part of the brain, what lobe that's going to be going through, right? The frontal lobes. And the most singular circumstances connected with this melancholy affair is that he was alive at 2 o'clock this afternoon and in full possession of his reason and free from pain, right? Amazing. This was one of the first cases that let neuroscientists get a glimpse into what the frontal lobes do, because this man, through a tragic accident, had them knocked out of his head. He was in full possession of his reason and free from pain. So what do these lobes do? Basically, far from being in possession of his reason, it turns out that Phineas Gage underwent a serious and radical personality disorder in which he became very volatile. He had angry outbursts. He had difficulty controlling himself. He had difficulty with long-term planning. He began swearing and cheating on his wife when before he had been a very sweet and loving man by all of his friends' accounts. He became very irresponsible, gambled away all his money, and was prone to flying into rages, right? That gives us a little bit of a sense what the frontal lobes are doing in most people. They're inhibiting inappropriate emotion. They're helping you to be planful and strategic about what your long-term implications of your actions are, things like that. And the frontal lobes, because of this, it makes sense that they are the largest, the most proportionately expanded in the human species compared to other primates and compared to other mammals. We're not the species with the biggest brain for our body or anything like that. People tend to say that. Things like animals like chihuahuas and house mice have much bigger brain-to-body ratios than we do for different reasons. Which I won't get into here, but basically what we do have is a proportionately bigger frontal cortex, prefrontal lobes, the parts that are inhibitory, the parts that control us, that let us think long term and plan. Those are what humans are especially good at. Okay? And frontal lobe patients, other kinds of patients, for instance, there's a kind of nasal abscess that, if left unchecked, can push on your frontal lobes and damage them. There's a famous case of a man who had a personality change because of that. Have reinforced the interpretation of what the frontal lobes do. Also, single-cell recording in monkeys, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, so dorso back, lateral on the sides, in their prefrontal, the very front of their cortex, has revealed actual individual neurons that can be correlated with a monkey's activity and planfulness. So, for instance, you can train a monkey on a task which involves inhibition. So the kind of task is that the monkey's sitting there in front of a screen, and behind there's a lever, and he can push the lever to raise the screen and get some food. And he knows that he can push the lever and get the food, but there's a light bulb that's on, and he has to wait for the light bulb to go off to push the lever. If he pushes the lever while the light bulb is still on, then he will lose his chance to get the food. So it's an inhibitory response. He has to wait for the light to go off and inhibit himself. And they've actually done they can put little electrodes into the cortex of the monkey as the monkey's doing the task and record the activity of individual neurons, and they can correlate the firing patterns of neurons in the prefrontal cortex with its ability, the monkey's ability to inhibit itself. So there are neurons that are firing at a particular rate as the monkey is waiting to push the lever. And if those neurons firing peter out, then you can predict that the monkey will sort of lose its train of thought and forget to push the lever. So you can actually correlate that with single cells in monkeys, and it's likely that you could in humans, but you can't do the experiment. And evidence from neural imaging also shows that the prefrontal cortex is active in normal controls during cognitive tests that involve things like planful functioning and inhibition, strategic games, things like that. Okay. So the developmental trajectory of the frontal lobes, there's evidence from postmortem studies like of myelination, so how much of the fatty tissue is wrapped on there, which gives you a sense of how efficiently those lobes are functioning. And this myelination, we know, starts in infancy, but in the frontal lobes it happens relatively late, not until middle childhood, and it continues, at least now it's being documented, into the 40s and 50s. So this is an area of the brain that's, whose function is getting more and more refined and sculpted all the way through at least the first half of people's lives. And that's sort of the wisdom part of the brain getting better and older. And there's also tests from cognitive studies in children and adults and prefrontal patients and animals like the Tower of Hanoi and the Wisconsin card sorting test, where you need to inhibit and change and switch strategies, those kinds of tests. And it's interesting to note that tests of prefrontal function look a lot like Piagetian tasks of cognitive function, so his seriation tests and things like that. And it's interesting to just speculate now on what neuropsychologically he might have been observing, because he didn't have the tools then to look at that. So some major functional areas in the frontal lobes, and I want to point out that we're spending more time on the frontal lobes than we will on the other lobes, because these are the lobes that we sort of think of in a general sense as teaching to, as educators. Okay, they're not. Really, we're teaching to the whole child, the kid's body and the kid's brain all interacting together. But these are the lobes that are keeping the kid maintained on the task, interested and focused, interested in what's going on, inhibiting him from pulling, you know, Susie's pigtails next door, all that sort of stuff, right? So they're very important to us. And in the frontal lobes, there are sort of two areas I want to point out to you. So you're looking at the side of the brain. Here's the back and the cerebellum, and here's the front, and here's where the eyeball fits in, and this is right behind your forehead. And basically, the frontal lobes start with this sulci and gyrus right here. There are two sort of parallel gyri that go down, and I don't know if you can see them on there. They're hard to pick out, but they're the only ones in the cerebral cortex that are continuous all the way down like that, and they actually wrap around into the inside too. So there's one fold down the middle, and there's two gyri that run the length of it. And that is the division between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. And the sulcus that runs all the way down here is called the primary motor strip. And that strip of tissue has a somatic map on it, which controls the voluntary is a little word, the sort of intentional movements of the body. And I'll show you how that's laid out in a second. The other part I'm going to point out while I've got the model here is up here, this is called Broca's area. This is the part of the brain that was thought of as a language area until recently, but now it's known that it's actually involved in many kinds of sort of syntactic and linguistic-like tasks, including things like classical music. Okay. The primary motor strip is laid out like this. It's laid out like a homunculus. On the right side of your screen, you see the motor strip. On the left side, you see the somatic sensory strip, which is the parallel strip of tissue that runs down on the back side of that sulcus, and it's part of the parietal lobe. So the motor strip is laid out functionally, not just willy-nilly, but it's got a body map that grows out from the map of the embryo when it's first forming. Basically, the embryo starts out as a long tube with a hole at each end, and then the leg and arm buds sprout out from the middle, and that's basically how this is laid out. So you start down at the end with the swallowing and the tongue and the mouth, and then you move up through the face. Also, these things are not represented proportionate to the size of the structure, but proportionate to the amount of fine-tuned motor control that you have with the structure. So the face and tongue, for instance, and hands make up much more of the space proportionately than, say, the thighs or the middle of your back, where you really don't have to do much motor control. And it starts at your mouth, and it goes up, down your face, down your body, arms, legs, and to butt and genitals. And the somatic sensory strip, which is on the back side, is laid out very similarly. So the two things are sort of next to each other. So you've got the feeling coming in on the somatic sensory strip from the body, primary cortical area for feeling coming in from the opposite side of the body, right? And the motor strip, which is the primary efferent connections going out to control the body. And I'm going to go back for a minute and show you Broca's language area, which is the association area that I've chosen to point out because it's a major area in the frontal cortex. And it's going to also demonstrate some basic principles of the way that the brain organizes itself. Basically, this language area was first discovered when someone in a duel, in I think the early 1800s, was stabbed behind his left eye and he lost his language function. And that's why in phrenology heads now you've got language underneath the left eye, because he was stabbed there. But actually it went back behind his eye and hit him in the brain and took out his Broca's language area, presumably, and ruined his language. When you hit that part, when you ruin that part of your brain, if you have a stroke or something there, you lose your ability to do complex grammar, to string words and units of words together into syntactic units that make sense. Okay? The person cannot understand grammar, and they cannot produce grammar. They also have difficulty actually speaking and moving their mouth for language, although they don't have difficulty moving their mouth for other purposes like eating and things like that. And let's think about how the primary motor strip and Broca's language area are laid out on the brain. The primary motor strip, if you remember, had its mouth and face and tongue down at that end. Well, right next to that, further forward, we're getting from the primary, and we're moving more and more association as you move forward in the brain, is the control of language. So actually, language evolutionarily sort of hijacked or co-opted motor areas of the brain that control the mouth and the tongue and the larynx, and have sort of souped them up, in Liz Bates's terminology, have sort of expanded upon them and made them extra good at the motor, to the point where they became capable of handling these high-level syntactic and symbolic functions. So the point is that you can get something very abstract and high-level from basic motor tissue through evolution. And what's interesting now is that the specialization of that tissue becoming symbolic and syntactic and being responsible for the combination of discrete units in rule-bound ways, actually in deaf people who speak with their hands, right, they their language is in a visual spatial modality, we know that it's the right hemisphere that's primarily responsible for visual spatial type tasks. And that the deaf use location and chronological order, I don't speak sign language, but to map out tense and meaning in their language, that actually they still recruit Broca's language area to do this because it's the ultimate intent of the communication. It's the logic of the combinatorial units that's coming together to have a linguistic function, and that's why you're recruiting that part of the brain. So it's actually a part of the brain that's been hijacked or sort of co-opted over evolutionarily from motor control of the mouth, and now it controls these high-level symbolic functions, even if those high-level symbolic functions are being controlled through the hands. Okay, so now I'm going to take you inside the brain. You're cutting through this way and you open it up, and I've shown you that view several times now. There's a gyrus that runs along called the cingulate gyrus. It used to be called part of the limbic lobe. And that gyrus is sort of responsible for basic, you could consider it sort of emotional conscious functioning kind of thing. And you'll notice that it's located right between the prefrontal cortex and the limbic lobe, the limbic structures that are in the temporal lobe, which we'll talk about in a minute, which handle things like memory and assigning valence and fear and emotional stimuli. So it's sort of mediating between high-level cognitive processing, if you will, and sort of basic, this is good for me, this is bad for me, kinds of valence processing, kind of in between. If you have a lesion in the cingulate gyrus, you get things like akinetic mutism, if you get it in the right place, where the person just sits there like a lump and feels no desire to move or talk or anything like that, and they'll just sort of waste away. And patients who've recovered from this condition actually report that they just had no desire to eat or move or do anything. They just sat there like lumps and just didn't care to do anything. And so this is sort of a cutaway view that's been squashed of the limbic system and the surrounding areas. And it's kind of hard to interpret because it's been pushed flat like that. But I will show you on the model. I've got half of the brain here. I'm going to take off the cerebellum, and it's upside down. I'll turn it right side up for you. There you go. That's right side up, and here's the brain stem coming down. Here's the outside, frontal lobe, parietal lobe, temporal lobe. I'm going to take off the temporal lobe so that you can look inside here. Okay, let me put it right side up. There's right side up. So inside here are tissue pieces that wrap around on top of the ventricles inside the temporal lobes, and those are the pieces we're talking about. And remember, they're in between. The top, the prefrontal cortex, and that cingulate gyrus mediates between the two. There are a couple of parts that I wanted to point out to you here. One of them is the hippocampus, which is sort of a rim of tissue. If you picture the edges of the temporal lobe coming down and sort of those layers of six cells curling up on each other and making a little rim that runs like a little horseshoe up, you've got one on either side and they connect. Those are called the hippocampi, and those are specialized tissues for the consolidation of long-term memory. So basically what they do is there's a lot of evidence that this happens during sleep. They take experiences that you've had and they consolidate them into usable functional memories according to your own construction of reality with them, basically. So it reconsolidates them according to the meaning that you make. And at the end of the hippocampi on each side are little bulbs of tissue called the amygdalae. And what the amygdalae do is assign sort of basic valence to stimuli coming in and to experiences. So sort of, this is good for me, this is bad, approach, avoid, and especially they're responsible for fear. So, for instance, rats who have bilateral destruction of the amygdalae no longer learn to fear a painful stimulus, for instance. Something else I wanted to point out to you in here is the yellow band of tissue running through the middle. That's the corpus callosum again, right? So we're right underneath that. And then letter B, the little tracks coming out, which I can show you on the brain model. Okay, so this brain is upside down and missing its cerebellum. But coming out the front here, right behind the eyeballs, are these little tracks of tissue. Those are the olfactory bulbs. And you'll notice they run directly in and connect with the structure, these limbic structures that we're talking about. And that is why emotion and smell and memory are so closely intertwined. This is the only place in the nervous system where sensory information, here it's from the nose, right, goes directly into a structure that's going to encode it without it being relayed around first. So it's a very direct connection between smell and emotion and memory. And you can see why. Okay, so there's a famous patient called H.M. Who has had bilateral destruction of his hippocampi, and he was one of the first patients to teach us about what the hippocampi do. So you would go and visit H.M. He had to be institutionalized, even though he had a normal IQ and seemed totally fine. You walk into the room with him, you say, "Hello, I'm Mary Helen Mordino-Yang. I'm going to be doing some tests with you today." He says, "Oh, that's very nice." He's reading a magazine as he sits there. And you say, "Well, excuse me, just one moment, I need to run out." You run out and you come back. He claims to have never seen you before. He has no idea who you are. He's still reading the same magazine and the same page and doesn't realize that he's read it every day for the last 2 weeks. He's totally happy with that. Here's a man who cannot form new long-term memories. Now, what was especially interesting is that he could still retain and tell you about his childhood and other previously long-term memories that have been consolidated previous to his hippocampal damage. So what that means is that the hippocampus is not the site of the long-term memories. The long-term memories reside somewhere else, presumably in the cortex, and presumably in the association areas that made sense of them at the time of the experience. But that they, that the hippocampus performs a function in organizing them so that they're retrievable later. But that it's not the memories themselves. Okay. So there's other kinds of interesting neurological evidence, like patients who can show dissociated long and short-term memory, as well as sort of intact long-term memories, coupled with an inability to form new long-term memories, right, like HM. And there's bilateral amygdala damage, which leads to the inability to feel or perceive others' feelings of fear, just like in the rats. And in rats, such damage leads to like inability to learn a fear of a painful stimulus, like I mentioned before. There's also some interesting work coming out now on the amygdala in language, being able to recognize emotion in people's voices and things, which I won't get into now, but that if you're interested, you could pursue. Okay, so now we're going to move into the temporal lobes, which are the lobes on the side of the head that are over the. We've been looking at the inside of the temporal lobes when we looked at these limbic structures. Now we're looking around the outside of the lobes, and the primary cortex that's in those lobes is auditory cortex. So you can see the strip that's labeled there, Heschel's gyrus, it's called. That's where primary auditory functioning happens. So it's not the first place that you hear sounds, but it's the first place that you can become sort of consciously aware of hearing sounds. And no surprise, part of the auditory cortex evolutionarily has been sort of co-opted again, souped up structurally to become what's known as Wernicke's area, which is a language area that is responsible for being able to retrieve meanings and put words together in a smooth way that flows nicely, okay? So it's not the grammar, but it's the meaning and the sense making of it and being able to put things together in a way that flows. So if you have someone with a stroke there, they look to a non-fluent, like a non-native speaker, like they're talking perfectly fine in Italian or whatever it is, but if you speak Italian, you realize that they're making up all kinds of words and that they don't make any sense. Right? Their grammar's there, but they don't make any sense. And interestingly, once again, sign language speakers who are deaf who have strokes in Wernicke's area, but they lose their ability to make sense. So the signs are there, but there are a lot of them are made up, and they flow nicely in the real way that sign language flows, but they don't make any sense to a sign language speaker. So in general, the temporal lobes include these primary auditory areas, the association areas that enable us to interpret sounds as linguistic or otherwise recognizable, like recognizing the squeak of an opening door, for instance, and the limbic areas that enable us to assign emotional valence to stimuli and memories, and the structures of the brain that help us learn and form memories. So one of the first senses that infants can gain mastery of is the localization of sound, and that's the early myelination of this lobe. We know that infants can discriminate linguistic sounds like ba from pa very, very early in life, okay, things like that. Whereas visually, they cannot discriminate things of equal precision. Okay, now we're going to move back into the back of the head, the occipital lobes across the back. And the primary areas that are in there are visual. That's where sighted people's first cortical representation of visual stimuli happens. So there's actually cells across there that play out like a schematic map of what you're seeing, okay? And what's interesting is that when you have a visual dream or a visual memory or imagination, if you close your eyes and call up the image of something, you're actually replaying and reactivating that same set of cells that was activated when you first perceived it. And that's what the memory is. The memory is actually re-perceiving it. And that's a sort of a general principle of how the brain organizes itself. There isn't a place where you do something and a place where you think about it. You think and do in the same place. Okay, it is the same networks that you're reactivating when you experience a memory or when you actually experience the thing as a perception. But what do these lobes do in people that are blind, people who are blind? That gives us a sense of how they organize themselves. Basically, when you're blind, if you have a lesion across your visual cortex in the back so that cortex is dead, you'll be blind. You can't see. But you also have no knowledge of what vision is or what an image might be. If you go blind in the middle of life this way, you'll forget what an image is. You won't be able to imagine what your husband used to look like or anything like that. You won't have visual dreams. You'll have other kinds of images we call auditory images and other kinds of thinking, but you won't have vision and you won't even know what vision is anymore. But people who are blind in their cortical areas back there, actually, if you clap your hands in front of their face or you go like that at them, will blink or they'll move their head out of the way. If a bus is coming at them, sometimes they'll be able to jump out of the way. And they will claim not to have seen anything and have no idea why they jumped. But actually, what's happening there is it's the cortical area that isn't functioning, but the subcortical areas that I showed you before in the brainstem and thalamus are still functioning, and there's a more immediate, quick track that the information is coming in through their eyes. This is if their eyes are intact and functioning. Coming in through their eyes, going to thalamus, and going immediately to sort of reflexive low-level functions that tell you, turn your head, something's coming at you, or blink your eyes, something's going to hit them. Okay, so they don't lose that, even though they lose conscious awareness of it. They don't lose that reflex, which is just demonstrates the layers of perception from the low-level sort of reflexive up into the cortex that we're talking about. Okay, and as you get further forward in the occipital lobe, you go from primary, just perceiving things and perceiving the angles at which they are and the ways in which they're rotating and moving and all those sorts of things, and making sense of them and identifying them as you move further forward. Just like when the prefrontal cortex, you start with primary motor, and then as you move further forward, you get higher and higher level grammatical functions and combinatorial skills and planful strategic thinking. Okay, what's also interesting about this lobe is that in people who are sighted, if there's been some experiments where they completely covered people's eyes that they cannot see at all, they're completely covered for a week, and they undergo intensive braille instruction in sighted people, these people at the end of the week will start to use their visual cortex attached to their fingers to read the braille. Okay, just like blind people use their visual cortex to, quote-unquote, read braille, right? And that just goes to show you something about the plasticity and the logic of the way the brain organizes itself. Is it because of the sort of logic of the way braille is laid out as sort of something that lends itself to sort of a visual-type processing, a sequential and spatial flat-type thing, perhaps? Or is it because, you know, that tissue is not being used, so it gets picked up for whatever skill, you know, is trying to find a home in the brain? It's unclear, probably some combination, but I just want to give you a sense of how plastic that process is, even in adults in 1 week. Okay, and I just wanted to give you a quick example about another basic principle of brain functioning that has to do with color vision, right? Many of us don't realize that when you're in a low light condition, like at night if you get up and there's just street lights shining in your house or something like that, you're actually seeing in black and white. but you believe you're seeing in color because your brain constructs the color from the expectation that it has of what you know your, you know, the color of your shirt or your pajamas is to be, okay? And when you see, so these are pictures of my daughter when she's about, you know, 14 months or something playing. And on the left, you see the picture as it was taken in the natural light. In the middle, you have my poor simulation of what it might look like in a sunset, for instance, where she looks a lot redder than she would normally. But we still, if you saw her in a sunset, would construct her t-shirt as yellow because in your mind, you saw it before as yellow, and you expect it to be yellow, and so you perceive it as yellow, okay? And likewise, that's her in low light on the right, where she's actually in black and white. And so the basic principle that's illustrated there is that reality is not perceived directly from the environment. You construct reality based on your own best guesses and interpretations and expectations, okay? And likewise, remembering does not involve replaying back reality, but reconstructing it iteratively and reevaluating it each time. So memories change over time, okay? Another example of this sort of cognitive construction is in the parietal lobes now. So you may have heard of phantom limb, where someone has a limb removed and it gets remapped onto another part of the body, for instance, because in this case, this man had his hand removed, and if you touched certain places on his cheek, he would claim that he feels you touching his thumb or his index finger, or however that they've mapped out his face on his cheek. And that is because in the motor strip, if you remember, the face and the hands were very close together, because it starts with the mouth and then the face, and then it goes down to the hands, which have a lot, a proportionately greater representation, right? The mouth and the hands. So the neck and the chest don't have a lot of motor control or somatosensory control, so they don't use up as much space. And the cells, those neurons, actually remap themselves. When they no longer found themselves getting any feedback from that hand because the hand was gone, they remap themselves onto whatever was nearby, okay? It's just demonstrating the plasticity in the brain. And there are certain kinds of patients called phantom limb patients who lose a limb, say, and then they feel pain in that limb later, terrible pain that they can't get rid of, even though that limb doesn't even exist. So they feel like their hand is clenched and they can't unclench it, and they don't even have a hand on that side, for instance. And what that is it's the spatial maps, right, in the parietal lobes, the association areas in the parietal lobes. So in this lobe, you have the primary somatosensory strip at the front. We've talked about that. And then you have the occipital lobe behind it with the primary vision coming in. And this lobe is bringing together all of the senses, the hearing from underneath, the vision from the back, and the primary sensing from the body. And it's bringing them together to create sort of a body image in space is one of its major jobs. And to sort of know where you are. You know right now sitting there that you have a left toe, but you know, left foot, but you don't think about it. You don't want to bog your resources down, but your brain is constantly maintaining that spatial map of where your foot is, that it's not kicking the person next to you, things like that, okay? So people who have a lesion in this lobe then can actually deny that they own a limb, right? They have a limb, they have a spatial map that's got a piece knocked out, and they will actually try to, you know, get rid of their leg and push it out of bed because they think that it's not theirs. And conversely, someone who loses a limb but has a perfectly intact brain can have this phantom limb syndrome I was talking about before, where they have a spatial map that expects there to be a left leg there. And when there's no left leg sending up signals, it constructs pain out of them. It says, I'm not getting anything from the left leg. It must be something wrong. It must be pain. I feel pain. And it makes pain. Okay? Gives you a sense of how the brain is actually constructing reality and not just taking perceptions in as, you know, green light hits the retina, you see green, or, you know, your toe hits the floor, you feel the pressure of your foot. You're actually expecting that pressure and you construct it in your mind. And now lastly, I have a little map for you of the brainstem. We've been talking about the brainstem and its sort of subcortical role in relaying the information up from the body to the brain, to the cortex, and back from the cortex down. But these are some of the structures. So the cerebellum that you saw on the back of the head all those times, that little brown structure, is involved sort of in smoothing and modulating the motor functions and learning. You saw a picture of a Purkinje cell from the cerebellum early on in the talk. When you saw that, it sums across lots of places. It's like a big neural net that just grabs up all this information and says, what's common between this time you walked upstairs and the last time you walked upstairs? Okay? And then that way you don't have to stop and consciously think about how high to pick your foot up every time you take a step or every time you walk on a conventional staircase, because your cerebellum has come in there and said, this is the general motor sequence that we're going to use all the time. Now, if there's stairs that are uneven or there are, you know, stairs from 200 years ago where the steps are small or something, then you have to consciously look and put your foot where you want. But if there are steps that are what you expect or the floor is flat, then you have a motor program that just kind of runs smoothly. That's your cerebellum. And there's also doing that for you. And there's also evidence that it's doing the same thing for higher level cognitive tasks, for speech and for other kinds of learning, that it's sort of smoothing out so you don't have to consciously and effortfully put together each unit every time. What's common every time you do a task just gets automatically run as sort of a program. Okay. And you can see the temporal lobe from underneath. And the medulla and pons, which are sort of very basic structures that regulate things like autonomic heart rate and digestion and those sorts of things. They keep you from being, in a coma. And the pons, which conveys motor information from the cerebral hemispheres to the cerebellum. It's a huge bundle of fibers that's connecting the cerebellum to the cerebral hemispheres and allowing it to sum up across like that. Okay, and if you have a stroke in your brainstem, you are in serious shape because you're losing very basic abilities like the ability to breathe or the ability to regulate heart rate, things like that, or the ability to maintain consciousness at a very basic level as opposed to being in a coma. Okay, so that's the end, and thank you very much for listening.